Hello, this is Esther Provlin. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Saturday, September 13th, 2025 issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And on to our first article. Blue Jays schedule probable pitchers, where to watch, and what's at stake in Game 2 versus the Orioles. The Blue Jays continue their three-game series at home against the Baltimore Orioles on Saturday afternoon. Here's what you need to know. Game preview. The Jays took Game 1 of this series in large part to three hits from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. while Miles Straw and Isiah Kinnear-Falefa chipped in with two apiece. That's allowed the Jays to get off to a strong start versus a team they've struggled against this season. The win improved their record versus Baltimore to 5-6, which means they could still win the season series with victories on Saturday and Sunday. Right-hander Max Scherzer will start Game 2 for Toronto. The 41-year-old has allowed four runs in each of his last three starts, while also serving up five home runs across 14 and one-third innings. Scherzer has been dealing with back soreness in each of his last two outings, and his health will be worth monitoring on Saturday as he tries to make the case that he should be a valued member of the Jays' playoff starting rotation. The Orioles will counter with the right-hander Tomoyuki Sugano. The native of Japan has pitched against the Jays twice this season, but both outings occurred in late March and early April. Sugano allowed five runs across 8 2/3 innings in those games, but he enters this outing having surrendered 14 runs over his last 12 1/3 frames. The 35-year-old hasn't earned a victory since August the 14th. The Jays bounced back from a series loss to the New York Yankees by winning three of their next four games. They will enter Saturday with a three-game lead over the Yankees for first place in AL East, while the Boston Red Sox are 4.5 games back. The Jays also have one more win than the Detroit Tigers for the best record in the AL. Game time TV probable pitchers. Looking ahead, the Jays will begin a four-game series on the road against the Tampa Bay Rays on Monday before visiting the Kansas City Royals next weekend. And on to our next article. Opinion. Canada is trying to protect CUSMA, or the CUSMA, in talks with Trump. Here's why these small exporters might not benefit. When the U.S. President Donald Trump increased tariffs on Canadian goods to 35% from 25% on August the 1st, many were quick to point out that most of our exports are exempt under the Canada-United States-Mexico Agreement, or the CUSMA or USMCA, depending on where you are. Prime Minister Mark Carney said that 85% of Canada-U.S. trade is tariff-free, while RBC found that more than 90% of our exports are exempt under the CUSMA. While in theory, most Canadian exports qualify for exemptions, in practice, thousands of small exporters don't. According to the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses' latest data, fewer than half, or 44%, of small exporters are compliant with CUSMA rules. That number drops to 30% among small retailers. While protecting CUSMA has to be Canada's top trade priority, complying with the agreement is not a straightforward process. Exporters have to navigate through a jungle of customs codes, assess the content of their products to determine the rules of origin, obtain production and supplier documentation and origin statements, and verify packaging and labeling compliance. One mistake can mean a lengthy and costly audit or even fines, and all of that needs to be done for the product that the exporter ships across the border. Records need to be kept on file for 6 years in case there's an audit. It's a compliance headache for the largest businesses with dedicated teams, let alone small firms. A small manufacturing company in Alberta told us that the key details are buried within complex regulatory language or across various sources, making it hard to follow information in a straightforward way. The business is also concerned about compliance paperwork, customs delay, and additional or hidden fees. On the East Coast, a dental practice in New Brunswick reported a lack of clear and accessible information around compliance requirements, rising fees, and confusing customs regulations. Before the trade war, many businesses preferred to eat the 2.5% most favored nation tariff rather than spend the time and money it would take to become CUSMA compliant. Now, these are the businesses forced to deal with a mountain of paperwork and likely hire an expensive consultant or face the consequences of a 35% tariff on their American consumers. Add on the U.S. decision to scrap its $800 de minimis, the duty-free allowance often used for direct-to-consumer sales, and you can see why small business confidence has struggled since the onset of trade wars. And nearly 4 in 10 small businesses are facing tariff costs, and they worry about having to make some tough decisions, such as laying off of staff, changing their business model, or closing their business model if nothing changes. Many small businesses are also having to navigate sectoral tariffs outside of CUSMA. A 10% tariff on non-CUSMA compliant potash and energy products, a 50% tariff on aluminum and steel imports, and a 25% tariff on all cars and trucks that are not built in the U.S. and a 50% tariff on copper, and a 35.19% duty on softwood lumber. These sectoral tariffs are having consequences. As one wholesale business in Manitoba put it, after having to decline customer requests for items that they'd been carrying for years, now we just can't justify continuing to purchase them with the tariff, so we're losing sales that we rely on as a very small business. The tariffs coupled with historically high inflation have dramatically changed the landscape for the industry. Not sure if it will ever recover. Unfortunately, it's an all too familiar worry these days. We need the federal government to take action. It needs to continue to work to end the trade war for good. But in the meantime, there needs to be concrete relief measurements in place that recognize that tariffs are hitting small firms hard. CFIB is recommending that the government take the money that it's collected in Canadian counter tariffs and rebate it back to the affected businesses, similar to the carbon tax rebate or provincial workers' compensation rebates. Alternatively, they could use the collected money to temporarily reduce the small business tax rate, allowing small businesses to keep more of their earnings and reinvest them back into their employees and operations. There are lots of ways to help. Shop at your local small businesses. They need your support more than ever. Every time you shop locally, 66 cents of every dollar goes back into the local economy, ultimately benefiting everybody in the community. The only thing we cannot afford to do is nothing. Behind every data point and statistic, there is a family-run store, a manufacturer, a retailer, an employee, a neighbor. If we don't help, it won't just be exports we're losing. It'll be businesses. And on to our next article. Opinion piece. If I were Prime Minister, a company founder and CEO chimes in on the 5 key moves that Carney needs to make. People are full of advice for those who have to make actual decisions. And it leads me to wonder what I would do if Prime Minister Mark Carney called me up and said, take over, do what you want. Here's what I would do. These are not easy moves, but they are necessary. Move at crisis speed, even if it's not a crisis. Remember 2020 when COVID-19 hit? Suddenly, governments across Canada that usually dithered about all kinds of issues acted at lightning speed. Within days, sometimes hours, they sprang to action with emergency response plans, wage support, border policies, and supply chain pipelines. It all happened at a pace that no one thought possible. We may or may not be in an economic crisis right now. Certainly, it seems we are, with the never-ending threat of Trump's tariffs and global trade tensions. Why wait to decide if it's a crisis? Our government should aim to function at warp speed. If I were running things, I'd make everything urgent. I'd create a rapid decision mandate for national priorities, economic growth, digital infrastructure, housing supply, and climate sustainability. It's always easy to say we need more consultation, but right now it's better to act fast and consult as we go. That's what our competitors do, and so should we. Speed isn't reckless. Delay is. Eliminate interprovincial barriers now. Canada is a country. We should act like one. It's commendable that the Prime Minister and our premiers are paying attention and working to knock down interprovincial barriers. But even the speed that they are working at, which is unprecedented, is too slow. If a Canadian-made product is cheaper to buy in another country than in another province, something is broken. I would fix this now. If U.S. President Donald Trump could impose tariffs overnight, which are bad, why can't we do the opposite overnight and lower trade barriers within Canada, which is good? Let's do it now and work out the details later. Drop the prime rate to get mortgage rates under 3%. Interest rates were supposed to be a monetary policy lever, but they're a national anxiety. Too many Canadians are not investing, building, or spending. It's not because they don't want to, but because they are terrified of what will happen when their mortgage comes up for renewal. It is a huge squeeze, particularly on middle-income Canadians. The Bank of Canada decides monetary policy independently, but Carney used to run the central bank and by most accounts did quite well. Right now the bank keeps hinting that it's open to dropping rates that stimulate our economy. But when? If I were running Canada, I'd send strong public signals. The bank should take the hint. A healthy economy needs optimism. Promote, don't punish wealth creation. When we say we want innovation, growth, and success, but we still tax ambition like it's a liability. You know this if you are a company founder, a professional, or a global earner. When you manage to break through in Canada, the message you hear is we need to claw it back. This often drives people to leave, look for tax havens, or sell their successful businesses to foreigners. Everyone must pay their fair share, but we shouldn't be using people's success as a crutch. Too often there's a disconnect when governments say they need to tax the rich, but hit people who are just breaking through to success. And governments aren't good at explaining what they're going to do with the extra tax revenue. You can't build prosperity by vilifying those who create it. If you want more people to climb the ladder, keep it strong and steady. Stop shaking it. Prioritize the contributors, not just the cases. I've built a successful business here and I've scaled it globally, despite the barriers Canadian entrepreneurs face. But I've also seen how hard it is to build momentum in Canada when you're doing everything right. We need to support entrepreneurs who contribute to the economy. It's a mind shift. And we need to do everything to encourage innovation, whether it's from a self-funded tech startup supporting Canadian IP or internationally trained doctors who could be practicing here tomorrow if rules were streamlined. If we don't fuel the engines of growth, there won't be anything left to redistribute. It all comes down to this. We should act like we don't have a lot of time. That's what I would do. If I were Prime Minister, Mark Carney should do the same. And on to our next article. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. GTA, police to ensure public safety at Christy Pitts Park, anti-immigration rally, and counter-demonstrations on Saturday. Toronto police say they will be on hand on Saturday to monitor a rally against Canadian immigration policies as well as counter-demonstrations planned for the same time at Christy Pitts Park. The Canada First rally drew headlines as well as condemnation when it was first announced last month. Organizers say that they're looking for true Canadian patriots who can't stand what is happening to our beautiful country to advocate against immigration and undocumented workers. They're expected at the park at 1 p.m. Diane Sack, city councillor for Ward 11, which includes the park, has denounced the event. Others quickly drew up plans for counter rallies. Several, under different names, are now planned to set, starting an hour earlier at noon. Christy Pitts is for the people, not for racist. Organizers of the No to Hate, Yes to Immigrants counter rally said on their event page, "Bring everyone you know and let's make it clear. There is no space for hate at Christy Pitts Park." The counter rally's description says that the park is an important space for vulnerable groups, such as migrants, invoking Christy Pitts history that includes an infamous 1933 riot that broke up between Nazi sympathizers and Jewish and Italian locals after gang members displayed a swastika flag during a softball game. Police say that they are aware of both events and that they will be there to monitor and to ensure public safety. "We expect everyone in attendance to follow police instructions. Police will take appropriate action against any concerns or criminal behavior that may arise." Sack said that she was deeply disturbed by the rally and that many of her constituents had written letters expressing their concern. "I am also appalled at the absurdity of these individuals who are choosing to do so in Christy Pitts Park, with its history of standing against hate," Sachs wrote in a statement on Facebook on August the 26th. She added that the counter protests show that in a spirit of opposition to nativism, jingoism, and racism remains a vibrant part of our ward. And on to our next article. GTA. A bad commute can be bad for your health, but just how bad is it on Toronto Transit? We find out. Your commute may not only be eating into your mornings and your evenings, it may be shaving years off your lifespan. For one thing, studies have shown that pollution from traffic commuters often can be detrimental to human health. Even for those inside cars and buses, it can raise the risk of early death by heart disease, stroke, and lung cancer. It can be especially dangerous for young children. A study from researchers at UFT showed the DNA of umbilical cords in newborns had been altered after being exposed to traffic pollution. There are also studies suggesting there's a correlation between commute times between the wheel and obesity and all the negative health effects that that can cause. And even if your commute isn't taking its toll on your physical well-being, it's almost surely affecting you mentally, with countless studies showing that commuting tops the list of workplace stressors. The daily hassle can change your life. It is scientifically a daily hassle. And Marissa Young, a sociology professor at McMaster, said it's something you just have to constantly endure without any real solution to help alleviate the stress it creates. Although Young's research has shown that commutes of less than 30 minutes can be healthy as a sort of transition period from work mode to home mode. Longer ones are ones full of frustration that eat into time with family and friends, can worsen your mood, and also have harmful health effects. A 2023 study found that Korean commuters with trips of an hour or more were 16% more likely to experience depressive symptoms. Another 2014 study from researchers at the University of Waterloo linked longer car commutes to lower life satisfaction, a heightened feeling of time pressure. Toronto commuters have it worse. None of this comes as news to Torontonians, who endure the longest daily grind of all Canadians, according to Statistics Canada, with an average of 34.9 minutes spent getting to and from work, with nearly a quarter of those trips made during public transit. That time, which was spent going back and forth between work and home each workday, is connected to one of Toronto's other notable features, the high cost of housing. As an affordable place to live has become harder to obtain, more people are moving farther outside of the city, said Jesse Rosenberg, the director of policy at the health equity research nonprofit, the Wesley Institute. Social connection matters for health. People want to be with the people they love. They want to be with people that they want to spend time enjoying life with, Rosenberg said. And when you're pushed out into the middle of nowhere, and when we don't have the public transportation network that would enable you to do that, that matters for mental health. And that matters for your physical health. And it seems like it's only getting worse. That 34.9 minutes is a 3.4 minute jump from the previous year. It may not sound like much, but with more Canadians going back to the office post-pandemic, it's meant that more commuters are spending more of their precious time on trains, buses, cars, and bikes. Daily grind slows to a crawl. As more people return to the office after years of being able to work from home and widespread construction from condos and transit projects close lanes, more stress has been put on our system and our transit and roads. For drivers, traffic has gotten so bad in Toronto that City Hall is hiring a congestion czar in the hopes they'll get the streets moving again. If you thought that avoiding the clogged streets might speed your way to earn your daily bread, along come persistent slow zones to ensure the subway riders also get to experience that grinding to a halt feeling. That's when parts of the subway aren't outright shut down as they are on more weekends. Those transit woes are only the most obvious sign of the funding constraints that the TTC has faced for several years. Its multi-billion dollar state of good repair backlog means that these closures nearly every other weekend, as well as the slow zones and unexpected delays, aren't expected to get much better without further funding from all levels of government. And not all commutes are equal either. For precarious workers, commuting can be even more grueling and may even prevent a person's ability to apply for better jobs, a 2016 McMaster study found. But what is not clear in the science and studies is what exactly makes a commute so mentally and physically exhausting. Is it slow zones or is it congestion? Unexpected delays, rude customer service, or really passengers? Loud music on the screeching wheels of a subway car? That's why the Star is testing some of the toughest daily trials the TTC puts Torontonians through each and every workday. Join us in the coming weeks on the subway, bus, and streetcar as we retrace the steps of everyday riders to find the worst commute in the city and understand what really makes a daily grind in Toronto such a, well, grind. And on to our next article. Forget building wars. No one is paying full price for housing in Toronto right now. Every week there are those who inspire us and those who disappoint us. Welcome to Champs and Chumps, a weekly feature in The Star, in which we shower praise on our best and lob virtual tomatoes at the people who have disappointed us. Plus, scroll to the bottom for the big number that defined the week. Champ Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo del Toro holds and richly deserves the keys to both the city where he filmed many of his Phantasmagoria classics, and to add to the Criterion Closet, the cinephile's treasure chest that the Frankenstein director more or less dreamed into existence. Chumps, Ontario Liberals. To call Ontario Liberals chumps is less insult than paraphrase of their own election post-mortem. The red team is vowing to become champs again with fresher messaging, broader appeal, and a push into the province's hinterland ridings. Champ Richard Penner. Richard Penner tried to solve the Batman-style problem of Parkside Drive's vandalized speed cameras by installing his own to catch the culprits. Unfortunately, they struck again, and like Bane, the Premier has sided with the villains, not Gotham's guardians. Champ Kahi Leonard. What would it have taken to keep Kahi Leonard in Toronto? A phantom million-dollar side job, a slice of the Leafs, and other questionable perks that seem to mock the NBA's supposedly sacrosanct salary cap rules. And now the figure that defined the week. And on to our next article. NATO bulks up eastern defenses to ward off Russia. Warsaw, Poland. NATO said that on Friday it's bulking up its defensive posture on its eastern flank bordering Belarus, Russia, and Ukraine with new equipment to deter potential Russian aggression following an incursion by Russian drones into Polish territory. The alliance's supreme commander in Europe said a new operation, dubbed Eastern Sentry, will add equipment from France, Denmark, Germany, and the UK to its existing air and ground-based defenses. The key to this is an entirely new defense design, U.S. Alexis Greenwich told reporters at the alliance's Brussels headquarters. French Rafale fighter jets, Danish F-16s, a frigate, and ground-based defense system have been pledged for the operation. Grinkovich said the additional resources will enable the alliance to plug gaps in the line and concentrate forces wherever they are needed while improving communications across NATO's entire eastern flank. Poland Defense Minister Władysław Kosiniak-Kamysz hailed the operation in a post on X as active deterrence and readiness to defend wherever needed. Multiple Russian drones crossed into Poland on Wednesday, prompting NATO to send fighter jets to shoot them down and underlining long-held concerns about Russia's three-year war in neighboring Ukraine expanding. Russia said that it did not target Poland, and Moscow ally Belarus said the drones went astray because they were jammed, but European leaders have expressed certainty the incursions were a deliberate provocation by Russia. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk dismissed U.S. President Donald Trump's suggestion that drone incursion into Poland may have been a mistake. He would also wish that the drone attack on Poland was a mistake, Tusk wrote in X, but it wasn't, and we know it. His foreign minister, Radek Sikorski, said that anybody suggesting that drone incursion was accidental is a willing accomplice to the spreading of Russian propaganda. Earlier on Friday, French President Emmanuel Macron said he would deploy three Rafale fighters to Poland, while Britain unveiled fresh sanctions on Russia's oil revenues and war machine. The security of the European continent is our top priority. We will not yield to Russia's growing intimidation, Macron posted on X. Macron said that the deployment was discussed with both NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. The new measures were announced by Britain on Friday, and that included bans on 70 vessels that the UK says are part of Russia's shadow fleet and transports Russian oil in defiance of sanctions. And on to our next article. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Reader Reading Service. World Briefs. Congo. Boat accidents kill almost 200. Two separate boat accidents this week in northwestern Congo killed at least 193 people and left scores missing, authorities and state media reported on Friday. The accidents happened on Wednesday and Thursday, about 150 kilometers apart in the Equateur province. One boat with nearly 500 passengers caught fire and capsized on Thursday evening along the Congo River in the province's Lukolila territory, Congo's Humanitarian Affairs Ministry said in a report. The report said 209 survivors were rescued following the accident involving a whale boat near the village of Melange. A day earlier, a motorized boat capsized in the Basankusu territory of the province, killing at least 86 people, according to state media. United States, troops to be sent to Memphis. President Donald Trump said on Friday he'll send the National Guard to address crime concerns in Memphis, Tennessee, his latest test of the limits of presidential power by using military force in Canadian cities. Speaking on Fox News, Trump said the mayor is happy and the governor is happy about the pending deployment, calling the city deeply troubled. He said, "We're going to fix that just like we did Washington," where he sent the National Guard and surged federal law enforcement. Haiti, gangs massacred dozens in a village. Dozens of people were killed in a fishing village north of Haiti's capital in the latest massacre carried out by powerful gangs in the troubled Caribbean country, an official said on Friday. At least 42 people were killed in La Baudrie, said Joseph Louis-Baptiste, a local government official. He told Radio Caribiz the killings began last weekend. Wire services. And on to our next article. New disability benefit can be a struggle to get. Canadians are being left behind by programs designed to lift them out of poverty. Ottawa. Last week, Michel Tremblay turned 43. Instead of throwing a party, the Guelph resident is staging a birthday fundraiser on social media in hopes of scraping together enough cash to cover his monthly expenses. Hearing this story, one might think that Tremblay is exactly the type of person that a new federal disability benefit should be helping. The staunch advocate has already survived 7 bouts of homelessness, he told the Star, and nothing terrifies him more than ending up on the street again. He suffers from debilitating mental illnesses and traumas that leave him unable to leave his home more than once a week. At times, he wonders if he is an expansion of Canada's contentious medical assistance in a dying regime, and if that could be his only way out. But as federal aid finally starts to roll out, Tremblay and others are being left behind. It's not because of their income or their diagnosis, but by the inability to get past a bureaucratic gatekeeper Ottawa has made necessary for eligibility. The Disability Tax Credit, a certificate requiring a form that is filled up by a medical practitioner that gives Canadians with long-term impairments tax breaks and access to a slew of federal supports. For years, disability advocates, doctors, and tax experts have issued stark warnings about the DTC. Critics have argued that eligibility is too vague and it's restrictive, and applying for it is too burdensome, time-consuming and costly for people living with severe disabilities. A United Nations committee report has raised alarms about the system, arguing that it was full of disparities and leads to unequal coverage. But calls for an overhaul are taking on renewed urgency as the federal government finally rolls out the long-awaited Canada Disability Benefit, a maximum $200 per month income supplement for working-age disabled Canadians who are living in poverty. Already frustrated advocates have argued the benefit falls far short of the Trudeau government's initial promise to close the gap between provincial disability payments and the poverty line. It's really hard to trust people at this point, especially the government, Tremblay said in a Zoom interview with The Star. We're at the point where we're dying or we're losing interest in politics altogether. Canada's a lie to a lot of us. The office of Patty Hajdu, the minister responsible for Employment and Social Development Canada, said in a statement that the government is committed to improving the benefit over time, but provided no specific details. Over time and through feedback, the government of Canada will improve the benefit and how to access it where needed, the statement said, noting that the benefit is the first of its kind in Canada and was backed by $6.1 billion in investment over 6 years. We will get this right. Canada is committed to making the eligibility and the application process for the CDB as barrier-free and straightforward as possible. For Tremblay, a lack of access to a doctor has left him unable to fill out the DTC form, even though he receives ODSP payments. He can't get federal disability supports. He's not alone. Millions of Canadians don't have access to family doctors or specialists, and doctors in walk-in clinics can be hesitant or unable to sign off on a 16-page form that asks for detailed information to prove the person's disability is so severe as to impair their ability to perform normal tasks. Getting a doctor to fill out the form can also cost more than $100, and it often requires reapplication after a period of time. The last time I had a permanent family doctor that was stable, it was when I was living with my parents when I was a kid, around 20-something years ago, Tremblay said, and the process is so tiring. He said, and it's easier to use his online platform to beg for help. Margaret Burnell, the president of the Canadian Medical Association, described filling out the form as a massive administrative burden for doctors. Many of the assessments are subjective, she explained, requiring time and documentation that makes it difficult for all sides. Obviously, it's more difficult for a physician if they haven't been involved in the patient's journey for a longer period of time, Burnell said. The federal government promised $41.5 million per year in 2024 to ease the financial burden of applications, but no money has been doled out yet. Even those who are able to fill out the form can face delays from an overburdened Canada Revenue Agency, which it says may take up to 15 weeks to process requests. And in the first 2 months of rollout, technical issues have prevented some recipients from getting the Canada Disability Benefit at all. And the government says that this happened to a few people, and those who are received for the benefit after its launch will receive retroactive payments. The supports are not there, said Elon Davies, who lives in Ontario with cerebral palsy and diabetes. He was set to receive $400 for the first 2 months of the benefit in August, and he budgeted for it, but nothing arrived in his bank account the day that it was supposed to. Efforts to get support through the government call center left him on hold for hours. Weeks later, the payment finally arrived. Out of nearly 900,000 disabled adults, Statistics Canada says live in poverty across the country, just over 156,000 have so far received the Canada Disability Benefit. The federal government predicted 465 1,000 adults would be receiving the monthly benefit in its first year, and 40,000 Canadians would be lifted out of poverty because of it at its peak. Not all eligible applicants were expected to apply at launch, however, and initial intake of CDB applications is approximately on par with the estimated forecast, a spokesperson for the Employment and Social Development Canada said. Brunel said that she believes that the government should simplify the process by accepting personal attestations. Some advocates have called for a harmonization of eligibility criteria for disability supports across the country, or at the very least, having Ottawa automatically enroll Canadians receiving provincial aid into the Canada Disability Benefit. The federal government has so far rejected the latter, arguing the DTC is the best way to ensure criteria for eligibility is applied equally to all Canadians. Provincial systems differ, and not all have their own systems, at the same time making disability supports across the country a complicated patchwork. Still, Ottawa has long acknowledged the DTC needs reforms, and the Liberal government has made several over the years. In a statement, a spokesperson for Finance Canada said the federal government will continue working with persons with disabilities, as well as with healthcare and tax professionals, to find ways to make it easier to apply for the disability tax credit, and will provide updates when available. And on to our next article. Business: high-speed rail work could begin by 2029. Montreal: the federal government wants construction on a planned high-speed rail line between Toronto and Quebec City to begin within 4 years. On Thursday, Canada-US Trade Minister Dominic LeBlanc said the government's new major projects office will work to speed up engineering and regulatory work on the Alto high-speed rail line. This is a very exciting project in a very densely populated area, he told reporters at a press conference in Montreal. LeBlanc made the comments at the Port of Montreal, where a planned expansion is among the first five projects under consideration for fast-track approval through the federal government's Major Projects Office. Alto was not among the five projects unveiled on Thursday, but the government has listed it with others identified for future development. Former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced in February that Ottawa had awarded a $3.9 billion six-year contract to a consortium to design the project. If completed, the 1,000-kilometer high-speed rail network would take passengers from Montreal to Toronto in just 3 hours on trains traveling up to 300 kilometers in an hour. On Thursday, LeBlanc said that the work over the next 4 years would determine the final route between Toronto and Quebec City. Imagine the assessments, imagine the Indigenous consultations along a 1,000-kilometer route, he said. It represents a significant undertaking. He said that roughly half of Canada's population lives along the high-speed rail corridor. LeBlanc said that it would have taken 8 years to begin construction of the rail project without assistance of the Major Projects Office, although it's unclear where that number comes from. The design contract announced in February, and that was for 6 years. At the time, Trudeau said the development phase might only last 4 to 5 years. Alto did not immediately respond to questions from the Canadian press. LeBlanc did not say when Ottawa hopes to see the first phase of the project up and running. Alto CEO Martin Imbleau has estimated the total cost of the high-speed rail project at between $60 billion and $90 billion. The Canadian press. And on to our next article. Zero appetite for arbitration, striking college staff's union says. The union representing 10,000 striking college support staff says that it has zero appetite for arbitration, despite its employer's call for it to help reach a deal. With this strike in just its second day and no negotiations planned, members of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union set up pickets at the province's 24 colleges on Friday. Their strike called early Thursday came after talks which broke off with the College Employer Council, which bargains on behalf of the schools. The council said that it cannot agree for union demands to guarantee no job losses or further program cuts. The council's been urging mediation or arbitration, saying that helped reach a deal earlier this year with faculty, but OPSCU president J.P. Hornick rejected the call. These are folks who really need to draw a line in the sand about what they need in order to preserve not just their jobs, but also the system itself. Hornick said, "We're not doing that. The team has zero appetite for arbitration. Workers know that there's more and that they deserve better." The job action could delay some labs and affect student services on campus, but classes are expected to continue going ahead as scheduled. Graham Lloyd, CEO of College Employer Councils, have previously told the Star that when employments and revenues are down by as much as 50%, OPSCU continues to insist on demands that are fiscally impossible given the huge cuts by the federal government to the number of international students, pay much higher tuition rates, as well as an ongoing tuition freeze and limited government funding. Lloyd has said that asking for a complete ban on campus closures, college mergers, and staff reductions could force colleges into bankruptcy. The council has repeatedly advised OPSCU that these types of demands simply can never be agreed to. The full-time college support staffers represented by OPSCU hold a variety of jobs, including disability services, library technologists, trades, co-op placement coordinators, food services, and IT. About 10,000 jobs have been lost in the college sector over the past year alone, out of a total of about 60,000 staff and faculty. The College Council said its final proposal included a $145 million boost to wages and benefits, including a 2% wage increase each year. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for Colleges and Universities Minister Nolan Quinn noted that, while not a party to labor negotiations, we're monitoring the situation closely and remain hopeful that all parties reach a fair deal that puts students first. You have been listening to reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Theatre Reading Service. And on to our next article. Ontario to restrict parking at daycares. The province's education minister is proposing new safety protocols for daycares in the wake of the crash at a Richmond Hill childcare center that killed a 1.5-year-old boy and injured 9 others. In a statement posted to social media on Thursday, the minister and Markham Stouffville MPP Paul Calandra said childcare operators should get rid of parking spaces that are immediately adjacent to entryways, windows and exterior walls of classrooms or playgrounds at childcare facilities, although accessible spaces would be excluded from those changes. The move comes after an SUV rammed through a large glass window at First Roots Early Education Academy near Yonge Street and Nottingham Drive Wednesday afternoon. A toddler was rushed to the hospital where he was pronounced dead, while 2 other children remained in critical condition as of Thursday afternoon. According to York Police, 4 children and 3 adult staff members were also taken to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Vinay Kumar Gupta, 70 years old, was arrested at the daycare and has been charged with 1 count of dangerous operations causing death and 2 counts of dangerous operation causing bodily harm. Police described the crash as not a deliberate act. Calandra also announced that he is ordering inspections to identify any vulnerabilities at childcare facilities across Ontario. "Our government will make any necessary legislative or regulatory amendments to municipal or landlord restrictions that currently prevent the installation of protective barriers, such as bollards, planters, elevated curbs, and other physical infrastructure to protect children and workers in these settings," Calandra wrote. The minister said that policy changes will apply immediately to all childcare centers in the province, other than those running in private homes. Parents and residents quickly flooded social media following the crash, discussing the lack of bollards or safety barriers separating the daycare from the parking lot. And on to our next article. Life: decadent churro croissants Hong Kong French Toast, a nostalgic dive bar nachos. One restaurant's executive chef shares where he goes in Toronto for culinary excellence. After opening a restaurant at the new W Toronto, executive chef Michael Harluck was lured away a year ago to the Hazelton Hotel, where he now heads up the kitchen at One Restaurant, one of Yorkville's most enduring spots. Beloved for nearly two decades of luxe yet playful fare like lobster spoons, Korean chicken tacos, truffle fries, and Boston cream donuts. Some of our longest standing dishes still draw people back after all these years. At the same time, our menu evolves seasonally to highlight new ideas and ingredients. The international backgrounds of our culinary team bring fresh perspective to the table, and the diversity shines in the food, Harluck says. It's a mix of iconic signatures and new creations that keep one both familiar and exciting. So where does Harluck go for his own favorite foods? Read on for the Toronto culinary excellence that makes his mouth water every time. Best bakery is Noctua on Dundas Street. That's my go-to. Everything they make is outstanding, but the true standout is their churro croissant. It's coated in cinnamon sugar and stuffed with dulce de leche. It's decadent, rich, and absolutely worth the nap you'll want afterwards. Hidden Gem, Simple Things on Dunn Avenue. This is a neighborhood spot that doesn't get enough attention. It's laid back, approachable, and delivers consistently great food with a lot of heart. It feels like a place that you'll stumble upon and then keep going back to. The Last Best Thing You Ate, Triple A Bar on Adelaide Street. This dive bar has always been one of my haunts for the last decade. I always get the nachos. They're not fancy, but sometimes those nostalgic, unfussy dishes hit the spot. Current obsession is Locust Corner at various locations. Their momos are the best in the city, pillowy, juicy, and served with this incredible house-made hot sauce that's fiery and addictive. I find myself craving them constantly. Fancy Dinner, Enigma Yorkville, 23 St. Thomas Street. It really does stand out in Toronto's fine dining scene, and the level of creativity and execution makes every meal there feel like an experience. Their tasting menu is beautifully curated and constantly evolving, and the space itself feels intimate and luxurious. Comfort Food is White Lily Diner. They do comfort food better than anyone. They grow their own produce, make everything in-house, and keep things simple, but really well done. From their pastrami to their meatloaf sandwich or patty melt, everything is done with so much care. Their daily donuts are also worth a trip. Best dessert is Sunny's Chinese. The Hong Kong French Toast, it's layered with black sesame jam, custard, fried, and finished with oolong tea condensed milk. Sweet, savory, and indulgent. Lunch spot is Elm Street Italian Deli. Their Tuscan braised beef sandwich is a favorite of mine. It's rich and flavorful, with tender beef that's been cooked down until it melts apart. The rapini is also a nice touch. The best late night craving spot, Raw San, Spadina Avenue. Their steamed black pepper short ribs are my go-to late night order. So much umami, so much flavor. It's a dish that hits all the right notes when you want something super tasty after hours. Best takeout is North of Brooklyn Pizzeria at various locations. I always order the New York style cheese. It's simple, classic, and consistently one of the best in the city. Best weekend breakfast place is Dad's Breakfast and Coffee at Dundas Street. I go for their breakfast sandwich. It's straightforward and satisfying. The kind of sandwich that you want on a Sunday morning with a coffee in hand. Favorite coffee shop is Arabica at various locations. I always go for one of their lattes. They're rich, creamy, and exactly what I need to start the day. The best cocktail bar is the Comrade on Queen Street East. I like my classic cocktails, and they make a perfect paper plane. The vibe is great for a nightcap, and they also have a great burger. The place I'm dying to try is called Lunch Lady on Ossington. I've traveled through Southeast Asia, and their Vietnamese-inspired menu really speaks to me. I'm excited to sit down and try it for myself. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Saturday, September 13th, 2025 issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your reader has been Esther Provo. Thank you for listening.